Please be seated. Welcome to the Arizona Court of Appeals for Division One. We are broadcasting live on YouTube and also recording on YouTube. So when you step up to speak, counsel, please state your name and the name of the client that you represent. We're here today for argument in the matter of Vermadal et al. Versus Heath et al., which is our case numbers CACV 250281. And CACV 250593. We did conference your case this morning. We've reviewed the briefs thoroughly and discussed the record in the brief, so please do assume our familiarity with the matter so you don't need to repeat points you've made in the brief necessarily. You also don't need to use your entire 20 minutes, although I'm banking based on the pages here, you're probably going to use all 20, and that's fine too. When it comes to minding your time, appellant, you can tell us an amount of time you'd like to reserve, and we'll try to honor that, but ultimately, as is the case in these fora, that's on you. And there's a red light there to show you your time, so whenever you would like to begin, counsel for the appellants.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Dean Batchelder. I'm from the law office of Berg Simpson, and we're here on behalf of the Vermadals, the appellant and the cross appellant. I know it's on me, you just said judge, and I recognize that. I'm going to shoot for 5 minutes, but we'll see how I do. This case is about a horse, as you all know, Charlie, and Mary Vermadal was sold a horse that was not sound, and she's entitled to proceed to the jury with her claim to recover the money she paid for the horse. There's four issues on appeal. There's two in our appeal and two in the cross appeal. And I'm going to focus my remarks on our issues, but of course I want to talk about what you want to talk about. So if you have questions, please direct me there. On the first issue in our appeal, it's that our contention is that the Heath's motion for summary judgment was improvidently granted because there's disputed questions of fact. And the second issue is that the Heath 702 challenge to Dr. Kaufman and Ms. Mahoney was improvidently granted because they're qualified and they have reliable opinions that they could share with the jury at trial. So starting with the first issue, that the Heath's motion for summary judgment was improvidently granted. Fundamentally,
those two issues seem to be so interrelated to me.
Your Honor, the R2 issues?
Yeah, I'm surprised you're starting, because it seems like the whole basis for the granting of summary judgment was the denial or the granting of the exclusion. So it seems like you would want to start with that one.
I'm happy to start there. But the first thing I was actually going to say was to that point was kind of two prefatory remarks, and we made them in our briefs, and I'm happy to discuss it, that the 702 and the motion for summary judgment, our position is those are independent, that Mary can, and I'm not being disrespectful, folks refer to folks by their first names down below, so I'll do that here. So Mary can proceed to trial on her testimony or other non-expert testimony, and she'd prefer to go with experts, but I think she can get there without experts, that she can testify she has experience as a horsewoman, that she rode Charlie before the sale, she rode him after the sale, and it was a night and day, a very different animal.
So without the experts, do you get the lidocaine in?
I think that you could. I also
How?
Think, well, if I might, I think you can. She can get to trial with or without the lidocaine as well, Your Honor.
Okay, fair enough.
Right, but I'm not fighting your question, but I do want to be clear. Our position is she can get there on her testimony alone. We think a lot more goes with her, but I think she can get there. It'd be her testimony and Walt's testimony and other testimony. Or I think the lidocaine could come in because that's really a question of fact. Is the lidocaine present? Or another question that might occur would be do the vet exams come in? Right, arguably that's opinion testimony, but it could be just I'm a veterinarian and these are the facts I saw with this animal, and I think those could come in as well.
So they could come in just as percipient witnesses and not as experts.
I believe that they could.
Okay.
I believe that they could. And so, but that's not, I'm not hanging my hat on that. What we're saying is Mary can testify, Walt can testify, you can have other clearly non-expert testimony, and you can get to trial on that because there's disputed issues of fact. And so that's why I was starting with the 56, Your Honor, because obviously we can get to trial without the 702, but we can't get to trial if we lose on the summary judgment.
You know your case better than I do, so I didn't mean to try and steer you.
No, Your Honor, it's a helpful question because we want that to be very clear that we view the 702 and summary judgment as independent. We want both. We think we're correct on both, but those are separate in our minds. And so that was one of the points I was going to make kind of out of the gate here. The other is on the summary judgment, pardon me, that the the court below didn't really offer any reasoning. It may have seen the 702 as dispositive of the summary judgment, but it didn't say that expressly, and it didn't really offer any explanation for entering the summary judgment order.
Do one-sentence orders from our Superior Court that just say, for all the reasons set forth in the papers, so ordered summary judgment, does that violate Rule 56A, and if it does, is that reversible error?
I think it's case-specific. I think the standard would be, is the record going to reflect the basis for the court's reasoning or for the court's order?
Do we have enough record to decide that?
I don't see
the oral argument transcripts from the summary judgment motions in our record.
I didn't mean to speak over you. I apologize. In this case, I don't think that the record does reflect that because there were so many arguments floating around about summary judgment. Down below, they argued kind of on a case, claim one should be knocked out for this reason or claim two should be knocked out for that reason.
I think you missed the import of my question.
Thank you, sir.
Have the oral argument transcripts from the summary judgment
here? I apologize. I missed that question. I believe they are in the record, Your Honor. But I think going through that, it would be difficult to tell, or one would be reading tea leaves to say why the court ruled the way it did. But I think to the rest of your question, if I may, is that reversible? Is a one-sentence order necessarily reversible error? I would say no. On the context of the case, if you have a single issue that the parties are litigating, and it's clear from the papers, there's one issue that's going to be dispositive, however it's resolved, and the court resolved it in this way, that's not problematic. You can tell what the court was doing.
Well, it's also not problematic because we can affirm for any reason in the record. So if there are eight different reasons in the record, maybe there's a failure to specify which one is the right reason, which is a Rule 56A problem, but maybe it's not reversible if there's seven other reasons, right?
Well, I think the difficulty would be then on appeal what's getting talked about. Because here...
For sure.
Right. I mean, you may end up with... I think you have one here if they want to get up and say the unjust enrichment claim goes away because of X. Mm-hmm. No, that wasn't the argument on appeal. The argument on appeal is there are disputed issues of fact. And we say... Or they're not issues of material fact from the Heaths. And our position is there are disputes of material fact. That's the issue before this court.
Well, they're saying the whole thing hinges on one fundamental question that cuts across all the claims. I thought their brief was nice to say that they all basically come down to that the horse was misrepresented and not suitable when sold. And you have eight flavors of that. And I think they're right. I think it's pretty simple, actually.
They said that below as well, that there's no dispute of fact, and that cuts the knees out from all of our claims. So I'm not trying to gainsay that. I guess my point here is you were saying you can affirm for any basis in the record, and I want to be cautious mm-hmm. that I don't have to guess that they're going to challenge my unjust enrichment claim on something mm-hmm. when they haven't argued that on appeal. That's mm-hmm. my point.
But we agree that 56A is probably not reversible error if you just say so ordered, or that your brief's kind of leaned that way, but it sounds like we agree that's not the case.
What I was trying to say was that in a case where it's clear what the dispositive issue is, this court doesn't need to announce a rule to mm-hmm. say, in all cases, no matter what, this is reversible mm-hmm. error. I think it's context dependent. And the question would be, can you determine from mm-hmm. the record what the basis for the court's order would be?
Well, I'll give you a friendly question. I think Judge Morris is right. I think the expert thing is pretty central to your deal.
Sure.
Did the court's small amount of writing about the experts indicate that the court sort of missed the point of some of your expert submittals?
I think it absolutely did, because it was focused on, I mean, you kind of have a baby in a bathwater problem, that they both went out the window, and there's, our contention is there's a whole lot of baby here, and, right, I'm not trying to be flip, right, if you have opinions 1 through 10, and the court takes issue with 10, 1 through 9 don't go, they're not out, 1 through 9 need to be examined as well, and so in the order it refers to, the order refers to retrograde analysis, or they don't know the timing of the injections. But that's not necessary for their opinions, and it's certainly not necessary for the core of their opinions, which really aren't that controversial to my mind, that Charlie the horse had lidocaine, Charlie the horse was lame and he hadn't been injured, and therefore Dr. Kaufman opined, based on his clinical experience of 50 years treating horses and using lidocaine, that lidocaine had to come from somewhere. And so, and no one in Mary's barn put the lidocaine in, so it had to come from somewhere, and it came from before the sale.
So what you're telling me, as I understand it, is that okay? So, and I think opposing counsel said this in their briefs, is that there was an acknowledgement by these experts that they could not that they were not credentialed to conduct retrograde analyses and couldn't definitively offer opinions within their expertise as to the timing of the letter. So exclusion of that particular opinion, you don't take issue with that. Your issue is don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, such as you were saying. Is that, am I on the same wavelength here? Or are we?
I think roughly, if I could put a finer point on it, I think certainly there are opinions that criticism doesn't address and that shouldn't have been excluded. So yes. And then also, are these experts credentialed with pharmacology background so they can testify about the metabolization of lidocaine over time? No, but could they offer an opinion that, based on their analysis, it is consistent with what they see, that there might have been multiple injections? I think they could offer that opinion. But could they get up and say, there was dose one of X milligrams and dose two of Y milligrams? No, they could not. But I think I want to take a step back.
So in your argument is that the presence of the lidocaine at whatever point leaves a jury question to a reasonable inference as to who may or may not have injected the lidocaine.
Yes, it is certainly a jury question in our mind. And there's testimony, and I don't think it's disputed, that no one on Mary's side of the V injected the lidocaine into Charlie. It's as if you go to sleep at night and it's not snowing, and well, maybe the weather outside. If you're in Flagstaff and you go to bed and it's not snowing, and you wake up in the morning and it's snowed, the fact that I don't have a meteorology degree doesn't mean I can't say there's snow on the ground. It had to come from somewhere.
Well, that's kind of like a jury argument, right? I mean, if your expert gets in and says there's lidocaine and it leaves the system over a period of time, they're still going to be allowed to say to the jury the same thing. They're going to say, we didn't do it either.
Absolutely.
And obviously someone did it, so the jury has to figure out who's perhaps telling an untruth, or unless there's some magical third means of administration, right? And that's a jury argument, not for us.
Exactly. I wish I'd said it that succinctly. Like, that's on both of these issues, on the MSJ and on the 702, our position is these are jury questions. And on the expert, we think they have the appropriate credentials. The court found they were qualified. The court found it was relevant. And so then if there's issue with one of the 10 making up numbers opinions, we can address that, but that doesn't mean the other 9 are problematic and are to be thrown out. And absolutely, right, their briefs are full of questions that they can address to the jury and that we'll have to answer in front of the jury. Our argument isn't that we win before you. Our argument is we get to go to the jury.
I want to ask you a quick question about actually their defamation claim.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which is the defamation per se doesn't require proof of damages. It seemed like the trial court was hung up on that. Isn't that a flaw with the dismissal of the defamation claim?
Well, I think, and actually if I might, before, I'm going to answer your question, but I just want to be clear. When we're talking about the defamation claim, and if I got to this, I was going to bring it up, there's an error in the brief, and it's our burden of proof to argue that the statement is true. And so we cited to the jury instruction, and we didn't acknowledge the note on use. So I wanted to bring that to the court's attention and apologize for it. But to your question, no, I don't think that calls into question the court's ruling, because you're correct on a defamation per se, you don't have to show specific damages, but you do have to show that this statement is defamatory in that it would call you into disrepute or
in their trade. If
yes,
it defames them in their trade, then it's defamatory per se, and it doesn't require further proof of special damages, right?
Absolutely. But if you look at the claimed statements, right, and you look at them carefully in their briefing below, and that's IR 105, the claims are very narrow. I keep saying claims. The claimed statements. Mm-hmm. One is Charlie was lame. That's a true and undisputed.
And we found lidocaine in the system.
Exactly. Those are both true, and I believe they're undisputed. There's no dispute that that lab result came back with lidocaine in Charlie's system.
I'm sorry, counsel, but I mean, is there any other implication of that statement other than they put the lidocaine in there?
Well, I was thinking about it. And
they were trying to mask a lame horse via lidocaine.
I think that's...
You were very convincing 5 minutes ago that these are reasonable inferences a jury can make, and they get to argue one side and we get to argue another. How is this not the same situation?
No, that's a great question. I think the first question is on a defamation claim. It's a question for the court. Can this statement be defamatory? And the jury implications or inferences don't come into that question.
Can the statement be defamatory?
Yes. And then as to the jury, is it defamatory? So your question was, is there any inference other than
that? At
this
point, the court should exercise, at least as I'm hearing your argument of the status of the law, is to say, can this be taken as defamatory? And then you argue to the jury whether it actually is or not. Well, and so your argument is there's no way this can be a defamatory statement.
I think, taking it piece by piece, is the statement itself defamatory, the literal statement itself? No. So then you're talking about the implication of the statement.
Can it be defamatory?
Yeah, and I believe that it's credibly not. I bought.
So you're saying that cannot be considered a defamatory statement?
Well, I think this isn't the hill I want to die on, but I think that's a fair argument. I have a car. I love it. It's a little race car. I bought it, and within the warranty period, it threw a rod. The engine failed. And that doesn't mean that that's a bad manufacturer. It just means that there was a problem along the way and something happened. My saying this car threw a rod isn't defamatory. Something happened, and you were talking.
It's kind of like yada, yada, yada in Seinfeld. It'd be like if I went and had surgery, and I went and had surgery with Dr. John. He was drunk. Now I'm paralyzed.
Well, but I think this statement here is there's no mention of the Heaths. There's no mention that they did anything wrong. For example, if you look at the Reynolds case, right, where you have that dispute between the siblings over their mother's failure to have a life care plan, it's in the briefs. But there the court said the fact they weren't arguing that the siblings did something wrong when they said mom doesn't have a plan. They weren't assigning moral responsibility or defame or attacking someone for that. They're just stating a fact. But if I may, I was saying this isn't the hill I want to die on. I think whatever however the court resolves that, these statements are true, and it's not disputed that they're true. And so whether or not they might be defamatory, your question started out.
Actually, they are disputed because they're saying essentially that you guys administered the lidocaine after the sale out of buyer's remorse is the implication I take from their theory of the case. So the statement the horse was lame when sold and medicated actually is disputable and defamatory in that sense.
But the statements they're pointing, I mean, I guess then we're talking about the inferences, but the literal, and so I don't want to miss the mark here, Your Honor, but I do want to come back to the literal statement is not untrue, that Charlie was lame. And an independent reason why the court's order is correct is that Mary was not negligent before she made those statements. She waited, if you look at IR 80, that's our statement of facts on the Daubert. On this motion below. Apologize, on this motion below. Mary said, I waited until I heard from Dr. Kaufman, and I waited until I saw the test results. So she wasn't out there shooting her mouth off. She waited until she heard from Dr. Kaufman. So our argument is that we believe they're true. We believe that they're not defamatory. And I understand I'm facing uphill on that, but that's fine. But also that it wasn't negligently made. She was not negligent in making these statements.
Thank you.
Please.
Why does her negligence matter?
Because that's an element of a defamation claim, that you have to have a statement made to another negligent as to the truth of the matter.
I think you've made your position. I think you want to save your 247, probably, counsel.
I do. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Morning, Your Honors. Jimmy Purcell, Quarles and Brady, for the Appellee Cross Appellant. May it please the court. There was a question that was asked, and maybe it was opposing counsel, that indicated, you know, what is being talked about in discussing the one-line order that says it's just motion for summary judgment is granted without the reasons under 56A. And I think that is exactly on point. Under 56A, it says the court should. There is the unpublished opinion from 2015, which is within the citable window, Valencia v. BP Ventures, that says that's not reversible error in the scope of a motion for summary judgment. And the reason for that, as Your Honors have pointed out, is the motion for summary judgment is reviewed de novo. In other words, you guys are going to look at the record as a whole and decide whether or not there's a material issue of fact in dispute that lets them get to the jury. It doesn't matter what Judge Ryan based his opinion on when there's a de novo review like this, because it's their job in the context of appealing a motion for summary judgment to point to the record and show where the material issue of fact is in dispute that allows them to get to a jury. If they can't do that, then you affirm. In this instance, what we've had, and this illustrates some of the frustration that we've had in dealing with this case, I think we used the term in our briefing, it's been a game of whack-a-mole. The story has evolved since the very beginning.
Well, let's go to the most important mole, please, counsel, which is the lidocaine. That's it, because that's the linchpin of the expert piece. The expert piece is all the way out. How is it right to exclude altogether simple scientific evidence of the presence of lidocaine in this horse? Why shouldn't the jury be hearing that through one of those two witnesses?
For the very simple reason that there's no scientific evidence in existence that indicates that lidocaine is detectable in the horse's bloodstream more than 48 hours after administration.
Well, actually, aren't there two different guidelines in the record? One they cite, which is a seven-day metabolite
guideline.
There's a seven-day guideline they cite, and there's a three-day guideline you cite. I forget the name. It's a French-affiliated thing, and theirs is an American thing. So isn't it 3 to 7 days? Isn't that, aren't they both in the record, counsel?
They are not.
Okay.
What's in the record is
the... What are the 3 and 7 day standards to which I refer, and why do they not matter in terms of what you're saying?
Okay, the seven-day standard that you're referring to is with the USEF, and I can give you exactly what that means here shortly. But it is a rule book that says this is how far back the administration of this drug needs to be before the horse is eligible to compete. If you examine the...
So that's unrelated to how quickly it metabolizes?
It's not totally unrelated, but it's not scientific evidence of how quickly it metabolizes. It's simply a rule. And as a matter of fact, within that citation, it says that this is not evidence of how quickly it metabolizes. It says simply, this is the rule. And it cites to the FEI, which is the Federation Equestre Internationale, as this is the organization that will really tell you about that. And what they say is, it is undetectable after 48 hours. And there's a 72-hour total withdrawal window, which means all the evidence says it's undetectable after 48 hours, but if you do 72 hours, you'll be 100% safe if there's a blood draw. That's what the science says. The science says, including this monogram that is in evidence, that scientific study took 10 horses and administered a lidocaine drip to those horses for a solid week and then cut that lidocaine off. And in all of those horses, within 48 hours, there was no trace of lidocaine in that horse's system.
Did you have an expert explain that to the court?
We do. Dr. Carter was prepared to testify and put that opinion. It's in the record. I don't know if it's in the record on appeal, but that was something that was presented to the court. They moved to exclude Dr. Carter for various reasons under Daubert, but their Daubert motion was considered moot given the ruling on the other issue.
So help me understand then, because it seems to me that the evidence that lidocaine was present is one fact, and then the retrograde, or that's not the right word for it, harkening back to DUI cases, but the dissipation rate is another factor. So why would the fact that you can establish, and maybe you could exclude their testimony about how long lidocaine may last in the system, but why does that get out the fact that lidocaine was found in the blood draws?
Because it's not probative of whether or not lidocaine was used to mask any condition of the horse.
So it's a relevancy issue, not a 702 issue.
For that issue, yes. For the issue of whether or not, let's say, for example.
So your argument is that the lidocaine is irrelevant unless you can establish that it could be in there longer than 72 hours.
Exactly. And in the context of, say, DUIs, if there's an accident, there's a civil case, there's an accident, the defendant's accused of being intoxicated, they take a blood draw 3 days after the accident and say, look, he's got a BAC of 0.5. That's not relevant. No court is going to let that in, given the science and given the fact that there's no evidence one way or the other. Both sides have said, we didn't give lidocaine to this horse. So if they're going to put that in the record, there has to be some form of basis to show that it is even remotely possible that that lidocaine could have been affecting that horse at the time of the sale.
What time of day was the horse sold on January 11th?
On January 11th, the pre-purchase exam was in the morning, roughly noon. They took the horse took possession of the horse. They took it home and then rode it that afternoon, several hours later, and they had no issues with the horse.
What time of the day was the sale?
Roughly noon, I believe.
The sale was at noon. What time of the day was the blood drawn on the 14th?
I think it was in the evening. We've calculated that out as 80 hours.
80 hours.
Correct. Okay. Which is, you know, in excess of the 72 withdrawal time period. Mm-hmm. And what makes that doubly problematic for them is, and they emphasize this point, it was astronomical levels in the blood. There's another point that needs to be borne in mind, and that's all of these expert witnesses, or their two expert witnesses anyway, neither are pharmacologists. They both conceded, we don't have any experience in doing any kind of retrograde analysis. We can't offer an opinion as to when it was administered. We can't offer an opinion as to how many doses, in what amount. We have no qualifications or no basis for making that determination.
You're sort of offering retrograde analysis of your own, though, aren't you? Like when you say the things you've said with the confidence and clarity you are saying them to us, right?
Well, it's not a retrograde analysis. It is simply the scientific studies that are undisputed in the record. If they had a study that said, okay, here's a study of a few horses that were given massive doses over a period of time, and 80 hours later there was still astronomical levels of lidocaine in the system, then we have a disputed issue of fact. We don't have a disputed issue of fact because their theory doesn't fit the science. If you're going to argue that there was something used to mask the condition of a horse, and one brief segue before I finish that thought, the horse during the pre-purchase exam was found baseline sound, but two on the lameness scale in both front legs under flexion, which means running around the horse is fine. When the doctor goes to flex the horse's forelegs, after that it's sore, and it was 2 to 5 on the lameness scale. Lameness simply meaning soreness. Lameness is not a condition. It's not something you can't just say the horse is lame. There has to be a reason for the lameness. There has to be a reason for the soreness. And they have offered not one shred of evidence as to what, if anything, is wrong with this horse. But the point is, at the time of the PP&E, the horse flexed sore, which directly refutes the idea that there's any lidocaine in the system. Because if it had lidocaine masking its injuries, it would not have flexed sore. It would have been 0 out of 5. It would not have been 2 out of 5. Dr. Kaufman admits that in his examination and has no explanation for it. All of this goes back to there's no material issue of fact as to whether or not the lidocaine was relevant because it's directly contrary to the science. There is not one shred of evidence to the contrary. And all of the evidence in this case makes clear that the horse was fine. The horse was fine. She rode it 3 times over a period of days. There's a pre-purchase exam. She declines a blood test. The horse is sore under flexion at the time of the PPE. She takes the horse home. The horse is fine that afternoon. She rides it the next morning. And then in the afternoon, the horse is a little bit sore, so she calls Dr. Strohsnyder to come examine the horse. And what does Dr. Strohsnyder find? Exactly the same thing that Dr. Buchanan found.
This sounds like a really good closing argument for a jury, counsel, but why, if we accept your position about the lidocaine and we accept your position about their experts, why wouldn't they, as counsel indicated at the start of his argument, still get to the jury just based on observational differences between how the horse was before purchase and after?
Because their burden of proof, Your Honor, is to show that the horse was lame at the time of the sale.
Right, and it's impossible to show is what you're saying. They can't possibly show that through lay testimony.
They can't possibly throw that, and I said lame, that's, I'm falling into the same trap mm-hmm. that everybody falls in, mm-hmm. that there's something wrong with the horse.
Right.
They can't tell you that anything is wrong with the horse as we sit here. And so the only thing...
You can't infer that right after you buy the horse and there's something wrong with the horse, that there was something latent and wrong with the horse, the jury could never reasonably find that based on he said, she said testimony? That's kind of what you're saying.
They haven't said what's wrong with the horse. We specifically asked Dr. Kaufman, mm-hmm. what's wrong with the horse? We don't know. It's just sore. This horse is a professional athlete, mm-hmm. right? the horse is going to get sore from time to time. When Dr. Stroh examined the horse after the purchase, he found the same thing except better. He found that the left was still sore, the right wasn't even sore, and what he recommended was mudding the horse and icing it after working it. It was still capable of being finished. He testified, my findings are consistent with Dr. Buchanan's findings. And so with that situation, can they show through lay testimony that something was wrong with the horse a couple of days after? Maybe. What they can't show is that something was wrong with the horse at the time of the sale. And their entire case has been built on, well, it was masked by lidocaine. We would have detected it in the pre-purchase exam, but it was masked by lidocaine. And the evidence that is in the record puts the lie to that statement. Because Dr. Buchanan found soreness, which he classifies on the lameness scale of 2 out of 5, same thing Dr. Stroh found. He found that lameness. He pointed it out to Ms. Vermadal. Ms. Vermadal says that's par for the course. She bought the horse anyway. You don't get to know about a condition in a horse such as 2 out of 5 on the lameness scale on both front legs and then take it home and have a veterinarian tell you the same thing and say, oh, now I want to give it back. That's not evidence that there was something wrong with the horse that she didn't know about at the time. And the problem with trying to whack these molds is you have issues with the arguments that are being made that are wholly unsupported. In the example, and I think opposing counsel has backed away from this as being important, but in their answering brief, they specifically state the following. She, being Ms. Mahoney, concluded the concentrations were consistent with repeated or prolonged administration rather than a single therapeutic dose. That's an actual statement, verbatim, from their brief, and it's important to their case because they have to have the repeated doses to explain why there was nothing wrong with the horse the 3 other times that they rode it and why lidocaine was used to mask the pre-purchase exam, which is not true, based on the clear evidence that it was consistent before and after. What do they cite for that? What do they give this court to support and create an issue of fact out of that statement? EIR 153 at 921-26 and 927-10.5. What is EIR 153? That's their motion for reconsideration. They simply cite their own argument. When you turn to that citation in the record, what you find is an argument to that effect that is devoid of citation to the record. There is one citation in that entire paragraph in that motion for reconsideration, which is the sole support for that argument. And that citation leads to a 3-line couplet in the transcript of the proceedings where she's asked, have you ever seen that amount of lidocaine? And she says, no. There's nothing in here about a retrograde analysis. And in fact, both of these witnesses testified, and this is all in the briefing, and it's got the IR sites, but I can give it to you. She was asked about a line in the report, a 9,000 to 2.55 ratio apparent substance to its metabolite indicated that Charlie had received multiple doses of lidocaine. That's in an expert report. She says, I do see that, yes. Okay, can you offer that opinion? No, I cannot. And then when you go through her opinion, Kaufman says, it's pure conjecture, we're just spitballing. I don't have any basis and I'm not qualified to render that opinion. And so to use Dr. Kaufman's word from Friday, this multiple dose theory, for lack of a better word, is simply a conjecture that can't be established from your blood test, can it? No, it cannot. And these are arguments that they are making trying to support this case, but the undisputed facts that, and again, undisputed, they can't point to anything that disputes any of this. She rode the horse on the 8th of January, it was fine. She rode the horse the afternoon of the 8th of January, it was fine. She was never restricted in the length of time that she could ride the horse and evaluate the horse. She rode the horse the next day on the 9th, horse was fine. She wrote, they did the pre-purchase exam on the 11th. The horse comes back 2 out of 5 on the lameness scale. She's aware of that. It's pointed out to her. She says it's par for the course. It's a little sore. It's normal for a horse of that age that's worked like that. That's also clear from Dr. Buchanan's testimony. So she decides to buy the horse anyway. The next day, she takes the horse out. She rides it in the desert. She works it a little bit, and she decides that it's acting funny. She characterized it at one time as a behavioral issue. She calls it elevating in the box, which is lifting the legs like it's sore. And so she calls Dr. Strohsnyder in, and Dr. Strohsnyder finds the exact same condition that Dr. Buchanan found, that he pointed out to her, 2 out of 5 on the flexion scale on the left, but Buchanan finds nothing wrong with the right, 0 out of 5. Better condition than at the time that he was sold. And then it's 2 days later that Kaufman examines the horse and comes up with basically consistent findings. And in his testimony, lameness, that's just the fact that the horse is sore. There is not one shred of evidence. They can't cite you to any part of this record to tell you what's wrong with the horse, if anything. And that's what's fatal to their claim. They haven't presented a triable issue of fact here because there is no record as to what's wrong with this horse. And the only thing they can point to from the veterinary standpoint is the same thing that was found and that she was aware of in the pre-purchase exam. And her lay testimony as to the horse being sore doesn't give rise to an inference that there was something wrong with the horse at the time of the sale, which is the key. The only way, and that's why they have emphasized at the trial court level and fought so hard with these experts, the only way they get past that hurdle, and Your Honor, I think you're spot on, without the lidocaine, it's all intertwined. Without the lidocaine, they can't get there.
Your argument, and I think, is that they haven't even met the standard to show that there's a disputed material fact that the horse is actually lame.
Well, that the horse is in some way injured or defective. Lame just means sore. Okay. That's what all the testimony says. But why is the horse sore? They don't know.
So your argument is that not only have they failed, the lidocaine doesn't really matter because they can't even show today, or they've presented no evidence today, that the horse is defective.
Exactly. And the lidocaine, I think Dauber is clear. They admit repeatedly that they're not qualified to render these opinions about the retrograde analysis. If Mahoney, you know, to the extent that the court were to find it relevant, can she say, yeah, these are the numbers? That's all she's qualified to do? Sure. Can Dr. Kaufman, as a percipient witness, talk about what he found? Sure. That doesn't get them over the hurdle. It doesn't create an issue of fact because it doesn't dispute what Buchanan and Strohsnyder found, and it doesn't establish that there was something wrong with the horse at the time. Briefly, Your Honor, in the 30 seconds I have left, I do want to talk about the defamation claim. Our briefing points out that Tyler Merrill and Amber Carroll were two of the people that were told about the lameness, alleged lameness, and the alleged lidocaine. That then was told to Jessica Pipkin, that comes back to Tony Heath while they're at a horse riding event. And that's all we really need to show. I think the only inference that you can draw is that that's a defamatory statement and we don't have to prove damages. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Let's run that back up to 3 minutes flat, please. Thank you very much. So you went 15 over, so you have 3 exact minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Please start off by helping me understand whether there is an issue of fact in this record as to whether lidocaine takes more than 72 or 80 hours to metabolize.
Is there a question of fact in the record? There's evidence in the – did I speak over you?
Just please, go ahead.
Yes.
Do it.
There's evidence in the record that that lidocaine can persist past 72 hours. There is evidence in the record. We cited to a source that says it lasts up to 7 days. So that's in the record.
And what about his point that it's a standard saying you're really clean by 7 days, that it's not an affirmative statement that it stays in for 7 days, and that the standard itself, he claims, somehow disclaims that very inference? Please speak to that.
Yes. Well, I think the question – so the question is there reliable evidence on which the experts can opine? And I think We believe we would dispute that characterization of that 7-day standard, and then we would also point to the studies they point to on the 48 hours or 72 hours. Those are on 6 horses mm-hmm. with a specific dosage, a specific location on the horse's leg. And I don't, there's nothing in there that says it does not persist beyond this. It's just, here's a sample of 6 animals, and this is how long it lasts in those animals.
Did you present any testimony via your experts or anywhere that says lidocaine can stay in the system for 80 hours?
And that's part of what happened, what I was thinking as you all were discussing it. Our experts are not pharmacologists. They don't have a white lab coat study, but they do have testimony that says, in our experience, these are massively higher doses, and it's a reasonable conclusion that it would last longer than 72 hours. So, one, we have the 7-day. Two, there's questions about the 48 to 72 study that they point to. And then three, in the clinical experience of Dr. Kaufman, right, his experience would allow him to testify that it might persist past 72 hours. So I don't have a study, Your Honor. I hope I'm answering your question.
No, well, I think so. But did he say he's seen it last more than 72 hours?
I guess I don't know that he was asked that direct question. But I think these are good questions for the jury, right, to say, because the standard, I believe it's, well, I don't want to guess on the case. I thought it was the Bernstein case, but I don't think we're in this box, but Arizona law permits, right, shaky but admissible expert
testimony.
That's
the comment to Rule 702 of the Arizona Rules of Evidence says precisely that, the 2014 comment. But it has to get over the hurdle of being able to assist the jury potentially.
Correct.
If it flat out can't, which is his point, then it doesn't come in. If it's shaky but admissible, so help us. You got 30 seconds. Shaky but admissible. Help us with that.
That Dr. Kaufman has 50 years of experience administering lidocaine every day, nearly every day, and in his experience, different doses are going to last different amounts of time. To have a 100-fold greater dose than a study, it's a reasonable for him to say that yes, that will last an additional 8 hours.
Okay, you're at time, counsel.
Thank you.
We'd thank both counsel for their excellent and helpful arguments. You've given us a lot to think about. We will take this under advisement and get our decision out in due course. Thank you all.
Thank you.